Grant gazed blandly at Sindri, then lunged for him. With almost supernatural speed, Sindri sidestepped, ducking under Grant's arm and taking up a position behind Grady. Grant stared at him in astonishment.
You want to go with him?
Sindri peered around the mag's polycarbonate-encased hip.
Frankly, I think it's a capital idea myself.
Sharp raised his hands, palms outward.
There you are.
Sindri only wants to go so he can use you, Baron.
By a pleasant coincidence, that's pretty much why I want him to go with me.
Sharp favored Sindri with a speculative stare.
A mutually beneficial situation, wouldn't you agree?
I would.
You can't trust him, Sindri.
But I can trust you? What did you intend to do with me after this crisis passed? Let me go on my way? Please.
We wouldn't have harmed you.
Perhaps not. More than likely, you would have kept me as a permanent prisoner. At best, you would have tried to return me to Mars, but in such a manner so I could never return to Earth.
Sharp shot him a startled glance.
Mars?
No one responded to Sharp's inquiry.
At least you'd be alive. With the Baron here, you'll never know where you stand. He could tire of you tomorrow and have you sent to Area 51 so your liver could be pureed and added to a chem bath.
At least we're the devils you know.
Sindri shrugged.
He casteth out devils through the prince of the devils.
Sharp frowned at Sindri.
I don't quite know what you meant by that, but I have the distinct impression I've been insulted. Still, on that note...
Baron Sharp swung his right arm out from the shoulder in a fringe-whirling circle, then stabbed a finger directly at the redoubt's entrance.
Let's take care of business.
Sharp, Sindri, and Crawler stepped toward the opening. Grady maintained a steady aim on Grant, the bore of his pistol trained directly at the center of his chest. Before they walked underneath the sector, Baron Sharp paused.
Regardless of how this meeting turned out, I thank you for the warning about the Imperator's plot. I promise to do what I can to ensure it never comes to pass.
And that's what this whole long, strange trip has been about, right?
Grady followed them into the dark maw of the redoubt, and within seconds, the heavy vanadium alloy portal descended, sealing the installation with a thud and a crunch of gravel.
If you want, we can try to blast the thing open with the Mantis rockets.
Grant didn't react to the suggestion. He closed his eyes the way a man in pain did. Lines deepened around his eyes and mouth, and his jaw muscles worked.
Zurui Chibi. Sneaky dwarf. I should have taken that literally.
He opened his eyes and turned to face the Tavs.
Never mind, Brewster. Prep your ship for takeoff.
Bridget forced a resigned smile to her lips.
Sindri was right about one thing, you know. We hadn't discussed what to do with him. You know, Kane wouldn't have agreed to simply setting him free.
I suppose so. We've done all we can do here. Let's go.
Climbing down the tumbles of rock was no more strenuous than climbing up them. They strode toward the Mantas.
So it's a straight shot now to Assam?
For me it is, yeah. You're going back to Cerberus with Brewster. Monitor the Elint signals that come in from the Vill so you can get an idea of Baron Cobalt's movements, if there are any.
Bridget was too shocked to say or do anything except to continue walking beside him. Her thought processes seemed numb. She was almost too stunned to formulate words, but she tried.
I'm not going with you?
No, you're not.
Grant continued walking. Bridget grabbed him by the arm and pulled him to a halt.
Why?
With an expression as impassive as if it were carved from teak, Grant turned to face her.
The same reason Shizuka isn't going.
Bridget blinked at him incredulously. Her senses stumbled.
I don't understand.
Kane and I discussed this before we left. We're doing it this way to further knock the timeline out of True, to put more obstacles in the way of Sam's great plan.
What's that got to do with sidelining Shizuka and me?
It's got everything to do with it. We have to change things in the here and now, and that means we shouldn't undertake actions that mirror those in the future.
Suddenly, it was clear to Bridget.
4+ years from now, both Shizuka and myself are killed in Assam. So you and Kane figure if we don't go near the place, you'll doubly ensure that aspect of the future never happens. You're trying to create a probability wave dysfunction.
Grant shook his head gloomily.
To be honest, we don't really know what the hell to think or what to do. We're just guessing. But we know it makes sense to minimize the risk to you and Shizuka as much as possible.
Bridget regained some of her composure, although her mind still raced. She realized Kane was driven to protect her through any means possible, and her initial reaction was anger and resentment.
I see.
She felt the familiar ache fill her whenever she thought of Kane. Questions always surrounded their relationship, and knowing they were to be married a few years in the future did little to reveal much to her. Yet, if the shared memory they'd experienced during a bad Mattran's jump to Russia was correct, they had been together before. A sick knot twisted through Bridget's stomach. The memory hadn't had a good ending, and there'd been no guarantee how together they'd been. Even Morrigan had told them they'd been together and separated a number of times in past lives. Grant levered his body atop his manta's wing.
I hope you won't argue with me about this, Bridget, or do something like fly back to Cerberus to pick up Shizuka and then meet us in Assam.
No. This is an unprecedented set of circumstances, dealing as we are with temporal fault and fracture lines. We might be able to repair one breach, but then another crack could open up. And it might be the one that swallows me, Shizuka, and everyone else.
Grant dropped into the cockpit and strapped himself into the pilot's seat.
Try to explain it that way to Shizuka, will you?
He grinned sheepishly.
I'm afraid she thinks I'm coming back for her.
I understand. I'll do what I can, so she will, too.
Phil Boyd pushed himself up from the cockpit of the second TAV.
I know you've got the GPS correlated with the parallax point, so your navigational computer will home in on Assam, but you could probably use more help over there.
Thanks, Brewster, but I won't know until I get there, and by then it might be too late to holler for help.
Looking down at Bridget, Grant looked almost grateful.
Thanks for understanding. Kane didn't think you would.
Bridget smiled lopsidedly.
Kane is the predictable one, not me.
In actuality, neither person was predictable. Both Kane and Bridget had their individual gifts. Most of what was important to people in the post-nuke world came easily to Kane. Survival skills, prevailing in the face of adversity, and cunning against enemies. But he could also be reckless, high-strung to the point of instability, and given to fits of rage. Bridget, on the other hand, was structured and ordered, with a brilliant analytical mind. However, her clinical nature, the cool scientific detachment upon which she prided herself, blocked an understanding of the obvious human factor in any given situation. Regardless of their contrasting personalities, Kane and Bridget worked very well as a team, playing on each other's strengths rather than contributing to their individual weaknesses. It had taken her several months to grudgingly admit she learned a great deal from Kane, and from her association with Grant and Domi. She had learned to accept risk as a part of her way of life, taking chances so that others might find the ground beneath their feet a little more secure. She didn't consider her attitude idealism, but simple pragmatism. If she had learned anything from her friends, it was to regard death as a part of the challenge of existence, a fact that every man and woman had to face eventually. But the questions surrounding her relationship with Kane still remained mysteries. It was possible they already knew the answers and feared to face them, not wanting to draw any closer than they already were in order to fulfill some grand scheme in which they were destined to play a part. It was also possible that she and Kane just found each other to be too much of a pain in the ass. That put a damper on love and lust, whichever it was they felt for each other. All the supposing made Bridget's head hurt. Grant pulled a bronze-colored helmet down over his head and slid shut the cockpit canopy. Bridget backed away as, with a droning whine, the manta slowly rose, a small and brief blizzard of dust swirling beneath it. The landing gear retracted automatically into the TAV's underbelly. The ship's ascent halted at 100 feet, and Grant waggled its wings in a farewell. Then the pulse detonation wave engines engaged, and the manta hurtled across the sky like an arrow flying from a bow. The sonic boom sounded like a thunderclap over Washington Hull. Bridget watched until Grant's TAV was a barely discernible speck in the sky. Then she turned toward her own manta, telling herself repeatedly that the cold, leaden weight settling in the pit of her stomach was only due to tension, not a prescient warning of death. The Cobra rose from the jungle floor in a beautifully graceful vertical glide. The forked tongue darted from its mouth as it rose at least 4 feet from the ground. Assuming a posture like an L, the serpent swayed slightly, its eyes gleaming like gemstones. Kane took a hasty aim with his pistol, aware that Domi had leveled her own semi-automatic. Madi suddenly swatted out with both arms, slapping at their weapons. Domi and Kane held their fire.
What's she saying?
I'm trying to figure it out, but it's evident she doesn't want you to shoot the snake.
Wodoste, Shiv bucked.
Something about the cobra being a friend sent by Shiva. Ah, I think I understand now.
The cobra's bobbing head was still framed within his sin-eater's sights.
Well, let us in on it.
Mythology. During the time of creation, some minor deities used the giant cobra Vasuki as a rope to use in the churning of milk. Torrents of venom flowed from the fangs of the suffering snake. The poison grew into a river and threatened to destroy all creation. Shiva came along, freed Vasuki, and drank up the poison. It burned his throat and made it permanently blue. As you can see, the scales on the creature's throat are blue. Apparently, Madi thinks that has marked it as a special cobra, a servant of Shiva.
And what does she think old Blue Neck is doing here? Checking up on us?
Yes, that's exactly what the cobra is doing. After all, we're at a shrine of Shiva, and it served as a doorway for his warriors to step through and end the tyranny of the Scorpia Prime.
Warriors? What warriors? Oh, she means us, right?
Right.
Madi spoke again, this time directing her comments to the cobra.
Dayakaro, amdost he.
She steepled her fingers, touching the tips to her forehead. The serpent stopped swaying and gazed directly at the girl. Despite knowing that snakes lacked conventional organs of hearing, Kane was almost positive the cobra listened to her. He discarded the notion as ridiculous, then reconsidered when the huge cobra majestically turned on its sinuous coils and disappeared into the undergrowth.
Apparently, the snake believes Madi that we are friends.
Kane lowered his pistol.
Friend or not, I can't say I'm sorry to see the damn thing go.
Kane's loathing of serpents wasn't pathological or due to any kind of inborn phobia, but drawn from a recent series of unpleasant experiences. First, there had been his encounter with Lord Strongbow and his mutagenically altered Imperial Dragoons with their scale-ringed, snakish eyes and reptilian odor. Then there was his terrifying battle with a gigantic constrictor atop a ziggurat in South America, in which one of the natives had been decked out in a feathered headdress and christened Kukulkan, in homage to the ancient Mayan god. That incident was followed only a short time later by walking a gauntlet of diamondbacks in California. His aversion to things reptilian was reinforced a few months before during his nightmarish bareback ride on a tyrannosaur he had christened Monstradamus in the jungle on Thunder Isle. Of course, Domi had been present during almost all of those incidents as well, but she didn't seem particularly upset by the appearance of the cobra, despite its huge size. She was revolted more by bugs than by reptiles.
According to legend, many animals are associated with Shiva. He is generally represented without clothes except a tiger skin wrapped around his waist and hips and snakes coiled around his arms and neck. These animals act as his eyes and ears, and they make sure no sacrilege is committed against his temples or shrines.
Will Shiva send animals to help us?
Raised in the outlands, Domi was steeped in superstitions and folklore and sensitive to omens. When Lakesh interpreted Domi's question, Madi shook her head gravely.
Wo hamare madad ke liye pashu nahi bajenge, magar wo hamare kaam mein dakhal nahi karega.
No, but Madi says that Shiva will not hinder us either. I suppose because the Scorpia Prime is defiling the name of the great mother goddess Shakti.
With the tantric sex rites performed at the temple?
Actually, not in themselves. Madi knows about sex since she's close to conception age. And Shiva is the god of regeneration functions and of sexual powers, after all. No, what she finds objectionable on behalf of both Shiva and Shakti is that the mystery and ceremony surrounding the tantric practices at the temple are being used to lure people to do evil. A reverence to the eternal principle of female sexuality, an aspect of the mother goddess Devi, the wife of Shiva, is an accepted part of her culture, and the Niroda are distorting it.
Frankly, I don't find the Shakti cult any worse than some religions Grant and I ran across in the Outlands when we were mags.
Lakesh nodded in silent agreement, realizing to what Kane was referring. Following Skydark, a few old, ugly Judeo-Christian and fundamentalist Islamic cults were revived. Their tenets were that women were little more than cattle, created solely for man's benefit, and they were inherently wicked creatures whose sensual natures had to be subjugated and suppressed, even if that meant murdering them.
At any rate, the Niroda, the followers of the Scorpia Prime, have a false god, or goddess in this instance. They have no courage and no honor, or so Madi claims.
Madi has made a lot of claims so far. I don't know how many of them are reliable, though.
Domi threw him a slit-eyed stare.
What reason she got to lie to us?
Kane shook his head, deciding not to make further comments about the girl and her beliefs. Madi was their only source of intel, and they couldn't afford to alienate her.
Will she guide us to the Temple of Shakti?
Apame mandir takle jayenge?
Agar me wapas gaya to, wo log mujhe fir se gulam bana denge.
She's afraid of being enslaved again, and I can't say I blame her.
Lakesh pointed to the leather collar around her neck. Domi drew the knife sheathed at her leg. She walked over to Madi, reaching out for her. Lakesh placed a reassuring hand on her shoulder, and she calmed down. The razored point of the knife easily sliced through the leather collar binding Madi's neck without touching the skin beneath. Domi hadn't been so careful when she used the knife to cut Gwana Teague's throat. The former pit boss of Cobaltville, Teague, had found Domi in the Outlands and smuggled her into the pits with a forged ID chip. In exchange, she gave him 6 months of sexual service. When 7 months passed without his releasing her from their agreement, she terminated the contract by cutting his throat, and saved Grant's life in the process. Domi spit on the collar and flung it contemptuously away into the shadows, a melodramatic gesture not lost on Madi. Rubbing her neck, the girl smiled gratefully at Domi. The albino smiled back.
Tell her, if she leads us to the Temple of Shakti, we'll do the same with the collars around the necks of all her people.
I think she's made that connection, darling Estwan.
Domi giggled and fell into Lakesh's arms. They embraced and kissed passionately, making Kane a little uncomfortable. Being privy to the relationship between Domi and Lakesh caused Kane to feel a quiver of embarrassment mixed with some guilt. A few months ago, during a mission to Utah, when he and Domi had shared a room, she made it clear she wouldn't be averse to sharing more than that with him. He had dashed cold water on her amorous advance by reminding her of her devotion to Grant. That had been the end of it, and he'd never mentioned the incident to anyone, not to Bridget, and certainly not to Grant. Now he wondered if he should have. He remembered Domi's wild behavior when she believed Grant had rejected her love in favor of Shizuka. Without Grant as the mitigating influence, the authority figure, what little self-restraint the girl ever practiced was completely discarded. All her bottled-up passions were unleashed, but turned from love to violence. Her shame, her mad desire for vicarious revenge against Grant, had been released during the mission to Area 51 and had set in motion a dramatic sequence of events, the fallout of which Cerberus was still dealing with. Shaking his head to drive away the memories, Kane peeled back a Velcro-lined strap on his wrist and consulted his wrist chron.
If everything went according to plan in Washington Hole, Grant should be here no later than daybreak.
Lakesh gazed at him speculatively over the top of Domi's white-haired head.
Assuming Baron Sharp attended the rendezvous at all, I still maintain he was a poor choice on which to hang the hopes of an Imperator-free future.
Other than Cobalt, he's the only other Baron any of us have met face to face. He may be fused out, but he can still be counted on to react like a Baron when his own best interests are threatened.
Perhaps, but we don't know the extent of Sam's influence over him.
Funny. Pretty much the same thing could be said about you.
Lakesh glared at him, his blue eyes suddenly glittering with anger. Kane met the glare with one of his own. He still hadn't grown accustomed to dealing with a robust, relatively speaking, Lakesh, whose eyes weren't covered by thick lenses, whose voice no longer sounded like a reedy rasp, and who didn't look like a hunched-over, spindly old man who appeared to have one foot in the grave. Domi pushed herself away from Lakesh and turned toward Kane.
That's enough!
With her back to Lakesh, only Kane could see the meaningful lifting of her eyebrows, a silent plea for him to drop the topic. Kane nodded, and Domi resheathed her knife with a flourish.
You're quite right. We still have Madi to impress, her confidence to gain.
During the exchange between Lakesh and Kane, the girl's dark eyes had flicked nervously from one to the other. Kane forced a friendly, non-threatening smile to his lips.
It's all right. Lakesh and I often interact like this.
Yes, indeed. And more's the pity.
Kane couldn't help but agree that it was a pity, particularly when he remembered all the bitter disagreements he and the man had over tactics. In the past, most of the missions Lakesh concocted never dealt with head-on confrontations with the Barons. Always they involved finding some way to strike covertly at the Archon Directorate.
not at their plenipotentiaries who actually held the reins of power. After Balaam's revelation that the Directorate was but a diversionary smokescreen created 2 centuries earlier by corrupt government officials and military men to mask their own ruthless ambitions, an entirely new set of strategies had to be drafted. The earlier tactics had been hampered by their own belief that they contended with a vast, omnipotent opponent, and by Cain's way of thinking, they wasted a lot of time and energy searching for ways to fight an enemy that didn't exist. But in retrospect, he couldn't really blame Lakesh, particularly in lieu of the fact he was the man who came to the pivotal conclusion that the Directorate was but a cunningly crafted illusion. Even so, he seemed reluctant to accept the findings of his own detective work, despite Balaam's essentially confirming his suspicions. But little of it really mattered at this point. Lakesh's self-assumed position as the final authority in the redoubt was no longer absolute. A smile tugged at the corners of Cain's mouth. It wasn't as if he, Grant, and Bridget had ever obeyed him unquestioningly in the first place, but now any proposals for action had to be agreed upon by a majority vote. Cain knew the man bitterly resented this change in procedure, but his plans had nearly gotten them all killed, worse than killed, on a number of occasions, often due to Lakesh's giving them just enough information to plunge them into serious trouble. He wondered if his sudden and uncharacteristic willingness to take an active hand in this op stemmed from guilt over all those previous missions that had gone awry. The decision of who would comprise the jump team to Assam hadn't been an easy one to reach. To Cain's surprise, there had been a number of volunteers among the Moonbase refugees. He was further gratified that when faced with the possibility of an assault on Cerberus, not a single one of them opted to cut and run. Of course, the only familiar place to where they could have cut and run was the Menetius colony, but Cain was still impressed by the fortitude they displayed. Lakesh, because of his facility with the linguistic groups of the Indian subcontinent, was a natural part of the team, despite his fear that Sam might interfere with the hyperdimensional channel opened by the interfacer. He had done so only a short time before when he abducted Quivel, rerouting the gateway unit's matter stream to Australia. According to Lakesh, Sam practiced a form of energy manipulation and interaction once known as geomancy, the art of using the mind to tune in to the energy matrix of the planet. Sam had a natural ability to manipulate the global energy grid. The Cerberus Mattrans network Lakesh had so assiduously constructed over a period of many years was only a synthetic, technological imitation of Sam's geomantic powers. When planning for the Assam mission, both Grant and Cain were adamant that neither Shizuka nor Bridget be a part of it. They weren't surprised by Lakesh's agreement to participate in a deception to keep the women out of harm's way. Domi broke Cain's reverie.
Anyhow, there's a long time till daybreak, and there may be 4 and 2-legged animals there who aren't working for Shiva.
You're absolutely right. And since you're so absolutely right, you can take first watch.
Had that in mind all along.
Domi rose to her feet, chambering around into her combat master with a blood-chilling clicking and clacking of metal. Cain watched the girl march toward the perimeter and wondered just what she had in mind. Skulking around in the jungle dark didn't sound like a pleasant way to spend the evening. But Domi was often motivated by little more than impulses, whims of the moment. Cain lay back on the soft grass, apprehensive, keyed up, and tired all at the same time. He closed his eyes after a time and slept. Almost immediately, it seemed he was awakened by a crash of static in his head, followed by Grant's voice.
Bamana 1 to Ground Force. Anybody reading me?
Grant dropped the Manta's altitude to 1,000 feet and cruised over a panorama of forested hills and wooded valleys. Colored by moonshine and starlight, the Goalpara jungle looked peaceful, almost bucolic. But he also saw huge strips of land where the jungle simply stopped. Foliage and trees turned to acre upon acre of brown desolation. It looked as if a sea of plague had washed over the forests, the farms, the paddies. Lifting his gaze, Grant looked out beyond the prow of the Manta at the snow-draped peaks and foothills of the mountains forming the spine of the Himalayas. They rushed up very fast, filling the inner curve of his helmet's visor, and he cut back on the Manta's airspeed, reducing it to under 1,000 knots. The maximum atmospheric cruising speed for the little transatmospheric vehicle was Mach 25, but he hadn't seen the necessity to boom through the sky from Washington Hole to India at such an air-scorching velocity. Grant's bronze-colored helmet was attached to the headrest of the pilot's chair.
A pair of tubes stretched from the rear to an oxygen tank at the back of the seat. The helmet and chair were of one piece, a self-contained unit. The instrument panel was almost shocking in its simplicity. The controls consisted primarily of a joystick, altimeter, and fuel gauges. All the labeling was in English. But the interior curve of the helmet's visor swarmed with CGI icons of sensor scopes, rangefinders, and various indicators. The Manta transatmospheric plane was not an experimental craft, but an example of a technology that was mastered by a race when humanity still cowered in the trees from saber-toothed tigers. The ships were of Anunnaki manufacture and design and had been found on the moon beneath the shattered remains of an incredibly ancient city, once protected by massive geodesic domes. The Mantas handled superficially like the Deathbird choppers Grant and Kane had flown when they were Cobaltville magistrates. But when he and Kane brought two of the Tavs down from the moon, they reached the unsettling realization that the ships couldn't be piloted like winged aircraft within an atmosphere. A pilot could select velocity, angle, altitude, and other complex factors dictated by standard avionics, but spaceflight relied on a completely different set of principles. It called for the maximum manipulation of gravity, trajectory, relative velocities, and plain old luck. Despite all the computer-calculated course programming, Grant learned quickly that successfully piloting the TAV through space was more by God than by grace. Skill had almost nothing to do with it. Consulting the HUD grid map icon, he saw he was within a 5-mile radius of the parallax point coordinates fed into the computer before embarking from Cerberus. Activating the comm system, he hailed Kane at the other end of the contact line.
Vimana 1 to Ground Force, anybody reading me?
He wasn't sure about the meaning of his particular call designation, except Lakesh had suggested it. Lakesh had made a brief reference to the Vimanas as ancient flying machines from Hindu mythology. Nor was he sure about joining Domi on an op. The half-feral Outland girl had proved herself to be a tough and resourceful, if not altogether stable, partner on various missions together. At one point, she had saved his, Bridget's, and Kane's lives when the Cerberus Mattrans unit was sabotaged. Grant had deliberately maintained a distance between himself and Domi, so if either she or he died, or simply went away, the vacuum wouldn't be so difficult to endure. He recalled with crystal clarity what she had said to him over 6 months ago when she confronted him about his reluctance to bed her.
If you can't do it, if you're imminent, then let me know right now so I can make plans.
Grant had angrily denied a physical disability was the reason.
That is me, you lying sack of shit. Big man, big chest, big shoulders, legs like trees. Guess they don't tell the story, huh?
That was pretty much the last private conversation they ever had. Her angry outburst cut him like the knife she turned on Guanateague. When he remembered the recrimination in her voice, he knew he couldn't make up for anything he had done to hurt her. He knew it had hurt the girl dreadfully when she learned about him and Shizuka, but he was sure Domi knew his decision to relocate to New Edo wasn't based on pettiness. Grant half expected to receive no response from the hail, and so he was slightly startled when Kane's voice, which sounded exceptionally startled, responded promptly.
Where the hell are you?
Coming in low over Assam. If I had my running lights on, you'd be able to spot me.
You're a couple of hours ahead of schedule. Did you have any problems with convincing Bridget and Shizuka to stand down?
None to speak of. Bridget understood where we were coming from.
The contact accurately conveyed the relief in Kane's reply.
Good. I hope Shizuka is as understanding.
Guess I won't know that until we get back.
How'd it go with Sharp? You make any progress?
Well...
Well what? Did you meet with the crazy bastard or not?
We met with him.
Tersely, Grant told him all that had transpired. Kane's reaction to hearing about Sindri's decision was close to what Grant had expected. Half a minute or so of vented expletives.
If you're thinking that Sindri and Sharp will team up, I doubt that will happen. They're too much alike temperamentally. They'll most likely try to kill each other. Or one or the other will have to make a break for it to keep from being killed.
Yeah, you're probably right. I guess they deserve each other.
Grant glanced down at his starboard wing. Through the helmet's infrared scanner, he saw the jungle blotched by patches of shimmering white.
Stand by, Ground Force.
Grant cut back on the Manta's speed and altitude, sending it in a wide spiral downward. He searched the darkness below and saw a massed glow. He corrected the Manta's navigation, swinging wide so as to approach from the northeast. The light was dim, the glow among the trees a shimmering, pearly sheen. Seeming to float in the air between his eyes and the visor, a column of numbers appeared, glowing red against the pale bronze. When he focused on a distant object, the visor magnified it and provided a readout as to distance and dimension. Now he focused on the structure rising from the lush tangle of foliage far below. A minaret thrust up from the center of a huge stone mass. Lakesh had described the ancient walled temple as being made of blocks of red sandstone, constructed to serve as a palace during the days of the Mughal Empire. Under the blended light of the moon and the stars, the walls held a rusty hue like old bloodstains.
What's going on? Where are you now?
I'm about 1,500 feet above a pile of rocks in the middle of the jungle. My powers of deduction tell me that since it's the only pile of stones I've seen so far in the middle of the jungle, it must be our hit site.
We met a kid who apparently was enslaved to rebuild the place. She'll guide us there at dawn, I hope.
My scanners are picking up heat signatures. I'm going to make another pass, see what kind of sensor readings I get, and try for a head count. Keep your comm frequency open, and I'll trace it to you. Can I make a vertical landing there?
Yeah. I don't know if it's such a good idea to buzz around the temple and advertise we're here.
It's also not such a good idea to charge into dark territory without having an idea of the opposition waiting for us.
Grant's reply sounded a little too sharp, even in his own ears, so he mitigated it.
I'll hook in the low observability camouflage screen and glide in on the gravity modifiers. Unless somebody down there is expecting a spy from the sky, I won't be spotted. Besides, I thought we're dealing mainly with locals, strictly knives and arrows.
The kid, Mahdi, says the Naroda soldiers have guns.
I won't give them a target to shoot at.
All right, but don't take too long. We've got some plans to make.
I thought the plan was to blow the fucking place off the ass of Assam.
We don't know the number of non-combatants. Any ass bombing will have to wait until after a hands-on wreck.
Grant opened his mouth to voice an objection, then realized there was no point in trying to argue with Kane over the topic of acceptable losses among innocents.
Understood. I'll make a couple of LOC passes, then meet you at the camp.
He touched a switch on the control console, and electrical impulses fed through circuitry all over the hull of the Manta. Dark ambient waves shifted over the bronze exterior, coating it as if by a film of India ink. Within seconds, the TAV was the hue of the night. Grant dropped the craft like a stone for 200 feet, then checked its descent. The wedge-shaped craft, now little more than a black blur against a deeper black, hovered almost directly above the temple. Firelight stained the darkness within the perimeter of a half-crumbled wall, glowing between the columns of the palace with a flickering, lurid radiance intercut with black, sliding shadows. He couldn't discern any details. Grant then slid the TAV forward and swept his gaze over the temple's architecture, noting the arches, the stairs winding up around a minaret. He saw a pattern of fluted columns, topped by snarling beast faces, the gaping mouths ugly with fangs. The combination of starlight and moonshine altered perspective and muted all the colors. Even so, he saw how the pillars were luridly carved to represent every conceivable sexual joining of male and male, female and female. It was a monument to eternal lust. A path stretched from the rear of the temple down to a bend in the wide stretch of the great Brahmaputra River. Assembled there on the bank, he saw a small collection of buildings made of rough wood and roofed by jungle plants. They looked like barracks or storehouses. There were open sheds for cooking, and behind them were pens for the stabling of livestock. When Grant's ears suddenly started buzzing, he jumped in his seat. He was overwhelmed by astonishment when he recognized the sound as the radar lock-on warning, piped from the forward sensor array into his helmet. Glancing out of the starboard side, Grant glimpsed a brief flash of flame in the jungle darkness. For a half second, he was too stunned to react, his eyes registering the missile lancing up from the forest, propelled by a wavering tail of fire, but his mind couldn't comprehend that the Naroda had access to both radar and surface-to-air missile emplacements. Grant's hand closed around the joystick control and jerked back on it. Then the night outside the Manta's canopy blazed with a sheet of flame. The TAV shuddered brutally under the jarring concussion of the missile's explosive impact. The confines of Grant's helmet echoed with an electronic cacophony of alarms as the pile-driving thunder of the warhead's detonation against the Manta's undercarriage flipped the craft over on its port side. The sky and jungle reeled over, the horizon tipping up and then down, spinning in a mad kaleidoscopic tumble. The TAV plummeted like a rock tossed down a well. He struggled with the stick, trying to bring up the nose, but the tree line swelled in the canopy. There was nothing left to do but pray. Grant managed to bellow one last message before the blackness rushed in and engulfed him.
I'm hit. Going down.
Kane had leaped to his feet as Grant's roar seemed to lift off the top of his skull. Cold terror tightening like a fist in his midsection, Kane watched the green jungle hills to the north, in the general direction Mahdi had indicated the Temple of Shakti lay. His eyes searched and scanned and finally caught a brief, almost subliminal glimpse of a firefly flicker of flame. It fluttered to earth, shedding a stream of sparks. Then it was gone, swallowed up by the night, as if it were nothing more than the final dying arc of a shooting star halfway around the world. Kane's heart beat fast within his chest as he called Grant's name three times without a response. Neither Lakesh nor Domi was outfitted with contacts, so they regarded Kane's sudden agitation and skyward stare with expressions of questioning surprise.
Grant just said he was hit, that he was shot down.
Incredulity shone in Lakesh's eyes as he rose to his feet.
Shot down by what?
He didn't have time to make a positive ID, but it doesn't take a lot of imagination to guess it was a surface-to-air missile.
He gestured in the direction of the flame he'd glimpsed in the sky.
Something sure as hell went down in flames.
Domi followed his hand wave, eyes wide.
They have missiles in that temple?
Worse. They have a means of detecting stealth technology so they can use their missiles.
He turned to Lakesh.
Fetish-worshipping natives don't usually have such things in their juju huts, do they?
No, they don't. Therefore, we must assume Sam has advanced further in building the Neruda movement than your future self knew.
Kane swung away from him, staring down at a sleepy-eyed Mahdi.
Will you guide us to the river right now?
The girl stared at him, confused and frightened by his aggressive tone and stance.
She doesn't understand you.
Then ask her yourself, goddammit.
Although he glared at Kane, Lakesh knew better than to chide him about his manner. He did as the man ordered, putting the question to Mahdi. Mahdi replied in her own tongue that she would do it, but didn't think much of the idea. She said it would be safer to wait until dawn.
Safer for us, not for Grant.
Kane picked up his pack and slipped into the straps.
Get all our gear together and let's get it done.
Within a few seconds, they were plunging through the damp, humid jungle. Domi's Nighthawk microlight emitted a 5,000 mini-candle-power beam, and it illuminated their path. They passed bloody, disemboweled remains, already crawling with ants. Mahdi identified the corpses as the Scorpia Prime soldiers dispatched by Shiva's tiger. They saw no sign of the great cat, and Kane was just as glad, servant of the god or not. Two of the corpses were completely ripped in two, huge sections of their spines missing, intestines looped across the jungle floor. The Neruda had not died easily. As they slogged across a stretch of marshy ground, they heard a liquidy growl from a copse of purple-leafed brush ahead of them. The four people came to a halt, and the Nighthawk's amber beam touched a pair of round, tawny eyes that shone like two yellow-green moons. Kane automatically tensed his wrist, and his sin-eater popped into his hand. A huge tiger limped slowly out of the bush. His black and gold striped coat glistened dully with a mixture of water, mud, and blood. Mahdi made a motion as if to render the enormous cat aid. Domi drew her back by an arm and lined up the boar of her combat master with the tiger's broad head.
This is the beast who saved her and her companion from the Scorpia Prime soldiers, who showed her the way to the Shiva shrine. It was obviously wounded by gunshots.
Mortally wounded, I'd say.
Kane felt a surge of pity for the great animal. The tiger lowered its head, and its immense jaws hung open as it panted. The long fangs gleamed with slaver and blood. Mahdi's eyes were brimming with tears.
She wants us to put the poor creature out of its misery.
Kane waited for Domi to volunteer, but she did not. Instead, she glanced at him expectantly over her shoulder.
It's not my place.
Then whose place is it? The tiger is suffering.
Kane lowered his pistol.
I don't feel I should be the
The tiger leaped, muscles rippling under its scarlet-streaked hide. The cat bounded straight at him, a blur of black, gold, and red.
Look out!
Automatically, Kane jerked up his gun hand and fired the sin-eater. Even as he did so, he felt bitterly sorry. The full-auto fusillade drove the tiger back, breaking the momentum of its charge. Jaws foaming with crimson, the cat staggered, regained something of its balance, and began another lunge. Hand trembling a little, Kane aimed carefully and squeezed off a single shot, putting a round into the tiger's head. Voicing a gasping growl, the beast slammed down heavily on the ground, its long tail lashing the air for a moment. Then the tiger expired, dying very quietly for such a fierce animal. Kane turned away, swallowing hard, shaking his head. Madi stepped forward and knelt beside the tiger, gently stroking its massive head as if it were a sleeping house cat.
Shubhatra.
She wishes him well on his journey to his next life and thanks him. She says they will meet again.
We got no time for this.
Lakesh urged the mourning, weeping girl to her feet. She regarded Kane with eyes like wet black diamonds.
Madad ke liye aapka shukriya.
She turned away, back toward the trail.
She thanked you, friend Kane. The tiger made the decision for you. In you, he recognized a kindred spirit, a warrior's heart who understood his own. So don't blame yourself.
Kane didn't reply, but only started walking again. Within 20 minutes of struggling through ferns, fronds, and vines, they glimpsed the Brahmaputra River, a wide, glistening ribbon. Under the combined radiance of the moon and the stars, it had become a running sea of silver, rolling between jungled banks.
From mystery above it flows to mystery below.
Kane didn't ask him what he meant. After a couple of minutes of searching, he found the dugouts. The four people piled into the longest one. Domi pushed the craft out into the current of the river with a long steering oar. All four of them paddled. Although the current wasn't exceptionally powerful, to make any progress at all required all of them working together, pulling and straining at the oars. Once they were past a small section of rapids, the course became easier. The dugout wasn't a clumsy craft, despite its crude appearance, but even paddling against a sluggish current, the canoe moved slowly through the shrouds of mist. Even at the halfway point between midnight and daybreak, the heat and humidity were oppressive. The air was heavy with moisture, tainted with the muddy, tropical fecundity of the jungle that brooded on either side of the river. Sweat gathered on Kane's face despite the temperature controls of his shadow suit. He strained to hear any sound in the night that didn't belong there, like human voices or mechanical noise, but all he heard was a chorus of frogs and insects. Despite his long training and staying focused on gaining an objective, Kane found his thoughts wandering to Brigid. He thought he had made his peace, as much as he was able, with whatever demon haunted their relationship. But knowing they were to be man and wife in the future, a future, he mentally corrected himself, not the future, affected him deeply. And it was a future he was now working to keep from coming into existence. He wished that he and Brigid could define once and for all the bond between them, but he doubted it could ever be done. The possibility of marrying threw any conjectures he might make even further into a bottomless pit of unanswered questions. Lakesh suddenly withdrew his paddle from the river. When Kane glanced at him, the man gave him a sickly, shamed grin and panted heavily. Unaccustomed to long periods of physical exertion, he tired quickly.
Almost completely around the world in a second with the interphaser, and now maybe 5 miles per hour in a boat.
Wincing, he worked his shoulders back and forth.
I feel like a worn-out Hiawatha.
Who's that?
Kane continued to paddle without breaking rhythm.
Sometimes I feel very sorry for you, friend Kane. You've no frame of reference for much of anything. You don't know the myths, the legends, the folklore of your own culture.
Kane cast him an over-the-shoulder glance.
We're making the new legends for a new culture, Lakesh. All of us.
Lakesh pondered that for a thoughtful moment, then slid his paddle into the water.
I suppose we are.
The river narrowed, the strength of the current slackening somewhat. The prow of the canoe continued to slide forward, propelled by the steady paddling. Insects whirled in such abundant clouds, Kane knew that if he, Domi, and Lakesh hadn't been wearing the shadow suits, not an inch of their bodies would have remained unbitten. He felt sorry for Madi, who endured the discomfort with silent stoicism. Domi suddenly stiffened, straightening and looking intently ahead. The moonlit river swept around a curve, and a mile ahead of them, just visible above the treetops, loomed a dark tower black against the star-speckled sky. Madi stared at it with a look that no one found encouraging.
That would be the Temple of Shakti.
And get a look at what's waiting for us there.
Grant awoke to a nostril-clogging stench, to heat, to a murmur of voices. He blinked in the dim light and saw a place where sewage and garbage were dumped. All around were stinking pools of slime. He was naked and chained to a wall. His head ached abominably, and thirst burned his mouth and throat. His belly quivered with nausea. The fact the stink in the room caused his stomach to slip sideways told him just how virulently repulsive the odors were. His thrice-broken nose had always been poorly reset, and unless an odor was extraordinarily repulsive, he was incapable of detecting it. He heard the muted, distant babble of many voices, but he couldn't pick out any single word. Whatever language the voices spoke in, it sounded like gibberish to his ears. Slowly, he surveyed his surroundings. In the gloom, things looked blurred, out of focus on the edges. Grant wondered briefly if he had suffered serious damage to his skull. A naked light bulb on the ceiling offered feeble illumination. He closed his eyes, palming them, felt the tug of the manacles, and heard the clink of chains. Shackles encircled both wrists, and the chains from them looped through eyelets on the metal belt locked around his waist. A chain at the rear of the belt was bolted to a bracket on the damp stone wall behind him. Experimentally, he opened and closed both eyes, one after the other, and realized the vision in his left one was impaired, as if covered by a translucent film. The flesh around it was swollen, very sore and tender to the touch. Grinding his teeth, he tried to stand. Cramping needles of agony shot up through his shoulders and arms. Nausea became a clawed animal trying to tear its way out of his stomach. It was all he could do to swallow the column of burning bile working its way up his throat. Not that vomit would do much to spoil the ambience of his surroundings. He stayed where he was for a long moment, breathing deeply. He was helpless, half-blind, and sick. When he felt better, using the chain welded to the belt as support, Grant pulled himself into a standing position, staggered on unsteady legs, and fell against the wall. He remained where he was, breathing hard. After a minute, he began checking himself expertly for broken bones and more severe injuries. He touched a lump at the back of his head, and his fingers came away damp and red. His head throbbed in cadence with his pulse. He figured he was suffering from a concussion. His right ribcage burned as if a hot, saw-bladed knife had been inserted there. He wasn't sure if he was suffering from broken or cracked ribs. The swelling on the back of his head was more worrisome. Reba would probably diagnose it as a closed skull injury, and he knew from his years as a magistrate that head traumas were always tricky. He could have sustained a skull fracture and be suffering from a subdural seepage of blood for all he knew. Mentally, he'd played back the glimpse of the missile flaming up from the dark jungle. He remembered the explosion and the dizzying spin into oblivion, but his recollections were hazy. His shadow suit would have cushioned the impact of the crash, even protected him from burns. That he survived the crash was not open to conjecture, since he hurt so much, but he had no idea of who had retrieved him and chained him naked to a wall. More importantly, he had no idea why. Feeling a stinging sensation on the side of his left elbow, he saw a tiny, crusted-over pinprick. Despite the cloying heat, he shivered. Not only had he been pulled from the wreckage of the Manta, but also he had been drugged, no doubt to keep him tractable while he was searched and stripped. Grim determination steeled his mind. Despite the blurred vision in his left eye, he examined the chains. The links were thick, too strong to break, made of high-grade steel. The bracket in the wall looked deeply sunk into the stone, but he pulled it anyway. It did not stir, nor had he really expected it to. A multi-legged insect scuttled over his foot and crawled toward a noxious puddle on the floor, startling him.
Fuck!
That will do you no good, you know.
Grant whirled, releasing the chain. A young man stood framed in the open doorway. Almost emaciated in appearance, he wore a white linen suit and white shoes that showed not a trace of mud. He apparently had not ventured into the cell before now. His face, despite its look of genteel starvation, was still a boy's face, pale, angular, and even rather cherubic, despite the dark glasses masking his eyes. His silvery hair swept across his high forehead. His appearance struck a faint chord of recognition, but Grant couldn't immediately place him. Still, he exuded a force, a broodingly powerful aura that Grant could sense. His nerves throbbed in reaction to it.
Who are you?
Grant made no attempt to cover up his nakedness.
You don't remember me, Mr. Grant?
Grant was in no mood to play guessing games, but he forced himself to respond.
I'm not sure.
Take a guess.
The young man reached up and removed his sunglasses, revealing a pair of haughty golden eyes that shone like polished ingots. His mouth curved in a vague smile, but it didn't affect his eyes. They were old, old with an age beyond human understanding. They were eyes that had seen birth and life and death in an endless stream, eyes that preferred death. Grant had seen those eyes before, even though the color wasn't the same.
Colonel Thrush.
The young man's slender body stiffened. His lips moved, twisted almost as if in agony. His upper body leaned forward as if with a desperate hunger.
Do you know who I really am? Tell me!
Don't you know?
I'm told my name is Sam, but my title is Imperator. But sometimes I don't think that's right. It's almost as if part of me, the true part, is sleeping.
He broke off, as if catching himself before he broke a confidence. He folded the earpieces of his sunglasses and tucked them into a breast pocket of his blazer. Grant nodded his big fists.
Why don't you come closer, Sam? I'll put all of your parts to sleep.
Surprised, Sam snapped his head toward him and rubbed his hands together in agitation, making a dry, papery rustle as of scales sliding across leather. He glared at Grant in sudden rage. The sheer homicidal fury in his eyes and face rocked Grant back like the blow of a fist.
Don't dare wake all of me. Not until I have built the world I want, rebuilt this one to suit me, so it will truly be a part of me. It will be the world of my dreams, even the people in it.